Kind of a different experience. This morning I won't be preaching to you. I won't be teaching a topic. I'm just going to be kind of telling you a little bit of the experience that I had while away. I was away for 10 weeks, and it was over this past summer. In case you didn't miss me, well, that just makes it awkward. I'm sorry? Oh, thank you, Larry. In case you're not familiar with the concept of sabbatical, it sounds a lot like the word Sabbath on purpose, because it was kind of coming out of the same thing. In the Old Testament, God instituted the Sabbath, which was a day of rest, Saturday, for the people to rest and reconnect with Him and each other, and then also instilled a Sabbath year where the farmers would let the crops or let the land rest so it could replenish the nutrients lost through 6 hard years of farming. It comes up, just as Dean mentioned, to be included in our employee manual, which I'm very happy. And now it's offered oftentimes to academic or ministry professionals as they kind of work through the rigors of ministry. And it's designed, as Dean mentioned, I have it a little different way, to rest, replenish, recreate, and reconnect. And different people do it in different ways because everybody's different. The way I would approach this, the way I did approach it, is very different from how Dean approached his. And that's okay. I met someone who is now a friend. There you go. Maybe that's how I should say it. Back in the beginning of August at a leadership summit I went to. And he had just finished his sabbatical. And he said to me, they shouldn't even consider sabbaticals unless they start at 4 months. And I was like, whoa, that's a long time, because I was literally finishing my 10th week and I was going a bit stir crazy. So, you know, I can't imagine a 4-month sabbatical, but that's what he was advocating for him and people in his field. But anyway, 3 things that I did on my sabbatical were recreation, whether it's formally a vacation or not. Well, it wasn't a vacation for 10 weeks, but we took a couple weeks, and I'll explain more of that. There was some education. In my case, there was not formal education, but there was a lot of learning going on. There was some reconnecting with God, and there was some rest. As I was reading and preparing for this over and over again, I heard people say, just take a week, the first week, and just sleep as much as you can. And it seemed weird to me. I didn't argue with it, but it seemed weird to me. So I took some chance to rest. Now, Dean mentioned I'm into year 8. I'm actually winding towards the end of year 9 now. So you might ask, if 7 years was the time frame, why are we talking about my sabbatical in eighth and a half year? Well, there's some reasons. A part of my employment agreement was that I would sit for the licensure exam to become a licensed pastor in the Evangelical Free Churches of America. Okay, cool. I can do that. But at the beginning, I dragged my feet for a few months, and I dragged my feet for a few more years, and then it just became embarrassing to me that it wasn't finished yet, and I kind of just kept, yeah, okay, keep not talking about it, kind of shoving it under the rug or whatever. So it became apparent that it needed to be taken care of. So one of my requisite responsibilities for my sabbatical was to return from my sabbatical with my paper finished and my other stuff prepared or well in hand for my licensure test. I'm happy to report my paper is finished, even if it is 4 pages over the maximum 20. That's their problem. That's why I'm looking at it. And my other reading is almost complete, and I'll go into more of that here in a few moments. If you're interested in my paper, if you're interested in reading 24 pages of where I stand on most major theological issues, email me. I'll send it to you. If you're not, then don't worry about it. You know, it's all good. And I've also, some of the reasons why I didn't get it done was because I realized that I have a streak just below the surface that does not like to submit to authority. It's not very far below the surface. Doesn't take long at all until it springs up. And it's something I'm working on, something that I've been aware of, and Dean has patiently and graciously been working through it with me over the last 8.5 years, but it still exists. And I also found out that I have a pretty significant fear of failure. And the idea of 20, 15 to 20 pastors sitting around a table firing questions at me about a paper I wrote, you know, 24 pages of worth, is my theological heart just poof, and they're like, in my mind, picking me apart. That's terrifying. It made me want to run for the hills. So it's some of the reasons why it didn't get done, but it is now complete, and I'm at the point where my issues are well in hand, at least for now, and I'm ready to move forward with that. So we did do some recreation. As I mentioned before, this was not a 10-week vacation. On May 31st, I mentioned, or the Sunday before I left, the day before I started sabbatical, I mentioned that Rhonda was starting a job June 1st. So I was heading out for 10 weeks. She was headed back to work. So it wasn't a vacation for 10 weeks where the family was traveling. I kind of wanted to do that, but she had to work and it required money and a vehicle that would survive. So we didn't do that. We did take a couple of weeks. We took a week and went to Ohio, back to Cincinnati where we were before we came to Crossway. We saw old friends, reconnected with people, went to church at the church I served at prior to, had a wonderful time. We took in a Reds-Phillies game at Great American Ballpark, and Aaron and I had a chance to be on the Fox Sports Ohio pregame show. Just saying. We were the people standing around going, it was a good time. But there was a cool trip out there, and then we came back to so Justin could play a baseball game. Let's see, we also took a week at the Outer Banks. We'd never been to the Outer Banks before. That was pretty cool. There's lots of water and sand. The water was really warm on the day we got there, and then it got really cold the rest of the time, so that stunk. But we had beautiful sunsets from our house, a time to just enjoy with the family. We took my in-laws along. We packed them in the trunk. They drove on their own. But we had a good time with them, and it was really a great time away. We also took a weekend at the mountains. Rhonda's mom's side of the family gets together every summer, and it's like 50 of them. And they get this huge cabin, and we spend the weekend together. We're the kids, now they're the parents, because both Rhonda's grandparents have passed away now. But Rhonda's parents' generation serve and plan and serve all the meals, and then we just enjoy eating them and laughing at the cooks. But we enjoyed the time together, but it was bittersweet this year, because that weekend was the last weekend that the family was going to be together the way it had been, because Rhonda's sister and family left for Haiti the next day to be missionaries. So it was a great time, but my brother-in-law, he and I had been friends all through college. That morning, he walks up to me and puts his arm around me and says, "Wow, this is harder than I thought it would be." So we cried a little bit or a lot, and we got ready to go. We were kind of having a moment of prayer, and then my brother-in-law looks back at his tire of his minivan, literally is bulging, ready to blow. So we quick go into triage mode. We get the tire off and we start calling tire places. Nobody's open. It's a Sunday afternoon in the Poconos. So we start driving towards the one place we could find, and the guy gives us directions. And as we're pulling off the highway, we saw like Vito's used tires, and we're like, "Hey, that's cheaper." So we pulled into Vito's and we told him what size we needed. And he showed us a stack and said, "Pick them." And my brother-in-law says, "All I need is for 4 hours." And he goes, "Lucky for you, these come with a 4.5-hour guarantee." So they turned us around. They got them back on the road. And then we could say it all again and cry all again. And but it was a nice time. But it was difficult, too. It was the same weekend that Amanda was planning on leaving. But she didn't get off for a little while later. So we spent some time recreating away. I also, if you heard me before I left, talk about movies. I kind of like movies. I got a chance to take in 10 movies I haven't seen before and a bunch that I have. And Justin and I, as the last one in my family that enjoys movies almost as much as I do, I was able to introduce him to some classics that he'd never seen, like Jurassic Park and Back to the Future, the important ones. None of those old movies from the 70s. But anyway, so we had some fun. I became, in some points of the summer, a stay-at-home dad. And I now have a tremendously higher appreciation for what a stay-at-home parent deals with. One of the things I hadn't thought about going into the summer was that the kids would be home. Hello. Should have figured that one out. Just never thought about it. I figured I'll be able to read, I'll be able to watch movies, and then they're home. I love my kids. My kids are great. My kids are smart. My kids are in the way a lot and very demanding. They wanted to go here. They wanted to go there. So I became taxi dad and all that stuff. But I really appreciate what you stay-at-home folks really accomplish in a week-to-week basis. It's quite amazing, and I never want to do it again. But I want to talk a little bit about the education aspect of my time away. Back in December last year, 14, I set aside, I challenged myself with a goal. John, you're going to read one book a month for the entire year of 2015. You're on it. Yeah. Well, that's not a big deal for some of you. Some of you like book people, like them. I tolerate them. I'm usually a 3 to 4 book a year guy. Maybe if I'm feeling it, 5. So 12 is a huge stretch. January started out fine. Well, technically I ended December's book in January and counted it. So that's another story. But so I got all the way through May and I was on schedule. 5 books down. I'm doing good. I got into my sabbatical and things escalated quickly. I had the chance to finish 7 books at my time away. And I finished a book and a half since I've been back. So reading has become more of a priority to me. But it's kind of a big deal, and I'm kind of amazed that I've been able to accomplish that. I'd like to give you a summary of some of the books that I've read, and some of the other ones I'm just going to mention and then move on. The first 4 books that I am going to refer to are the last 4 required for licensure in the EFCA. I read the first one back several years ago when Tim and I did our first year of Gateway. It's called Evangelical Convictions, and it goes through the statement of faith of the Evangelical Free Churches of America. If you're interested in that, it's an interesting read. If you're into theology, good read. The other 4 deal with the history of our denomination. The first one is called The Search for Identity, and it covers the birthing of the Evangelical Free Churches of America. Starting in Scandinavia, it started with two people groups, the Swedes and the Norwegian and Danish. They kind of I don't really know the connection, but one ruled the other one for like a long time, so they kind of associate together. But that's the two groups, the Swedes and then the Norwegian and Danes are over here. They came to the States and kind of grouped in their own little communities, as is typical, and they started communing together on the gospel of Jesus and eventually formed what we now call the Evangelical Free Churches of America, but that didn't happen until 1950. When the merger occurred. But anyway, this book is full of those who you might call heroes. I don't know if you'd call them heroes, but pioneers who did the hard work, spent the hours, traveled the miles to not just present the gospel to those people who spoke a common language and from a common culture, but worked with people who swore off denominations because of the bad experience in the state churches of Scandinavia to eventually form a denomination. So, I mean, there's a bit of irony there. But that's what had to happen to make the EFCA what it is today. The second book I read from the required reading was The Significance of Silence. This covered doctrinal hot buttons over the last 150 years. One of the first ones, the real pivotal one for the EFCA or for the free church people in Scandinavia, was communion. In the Lutheran state churches in Scandinavia, membership was expected. You just were a member. And then communion, the communion service held in the church was compulsory. So everybody was there. Everybody was a part of the service. Everybody was taking the bread and the cup. And it didn't even matter if you had authentic life-transforming faith in Jesus or not. You just were there. And the free church people were like, when they came to Christ, they were like, no, this is not okay. We cannot have priests or pastors who don't know Jesus giving communion to people that don't even care. We have to separate. Then eventually they did, and they formed what has been called the EFCA several times so far. Eventually it became that. But there were some other topics too. Baptism was a key point. In the Lutheran state churches back in Scandinavia, it was infant baptism. The believers, or the Free Church pioneers, took on the position of believer's baptism, that once you have a relationship with Jesus, only then can you really get what baptism is all about, and it becomes a public statement, personal public statement, that an infant just isn't capable of making. And that has become an issue where the EFCA has been quiet about. Like, you don't have to choose one or the other. They don't really talk about it. But most EFCA churches now hold the position of believer's baptism, as we do, because we see it as most consistent with Scripture. Two of the other main topics that were controversial 100 years ago, or even 150 years ago, were eternal security and end times things, the schedule of how things are going down in the end, which are both still controversial and well talked about today. The third book was Stumbling Toward Maturity. And this one covers more practical lessons learned along the way. Some things were tragedies avoided by the grace of God, and some things were learned through tragedies, in despite how much we worked to avoid them, or they worked to avoid them. One of the big things they had to figure out was languages. These were all people coming from Scandinavia, and they don't speak English. I guess they do a little bit, but that's not the language of Scandinavia, Sweden, Norway, or Denmark. So they had to decide, are we going to continue to speak our native languages, or are we going to transition to English? At the beginning, they were like, no, Swedish only. And then they're kind of like, well, we can do the kids' stuff in English, but all worship services must be in Swedish or Scandinavian or whatever language the Norwegian people speak. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Sorry. But whatever that language is, and then they had to realize that if they don't change to English, they're going to go extinct, because the culture is moving towards English. Their culture is moving towards English as they become ingratiated to the society in which they're living. So they eventually, as I am speaking in English, I think, chose to move in towards the English-speaking language. So that was an interesting kind of thing to read as they made that transition to English. The last book of the required reading is what it means to be free, and I'm halfway through that now, and I expect to be finished by the end of September, unless something tragic happens to my eyes, or something like that. I don't know. After that, I went outside of the EFCA reading, and I did some book journeying a little bit. The first book I read outside of that group was a book called Scary Close. This book is written by one of my favorite authors. His name is Donald Miller. If you've never heard of him before, one of his best books, in my opinion, is Blue Like Jazz. This is a guy that, anyway, I'm not going to talk about Blue Like Jazz. I'm going to talk about Scary Close. This book talks about his adventure toward marriage. He was a single guy who was living large, and he was having fun in life, not sinfully, but just enjoying the journey of singleness. And then he kind of felt his heart stirring towards marriage and what he had to process through to get to that point. He speaks about the insecurity that we all feel in life and how that prevents us from living in community, whether it's a couple community or in a church community, the way God designed us to. So instead of living the way God designed us to and the way that's most healthful for us, we choose alternate courses of action. Sometimes we create and tell stories that are safer or more gratifying to ourselves. Sometimes we manipulate others to get them to give us what we want. And sometimes we manipulate our own image to protect what we feel is not worthy of others. Whatever the process, what we're doing is cutting ourselves off from those who could love us best the way God designed us to. To combat this, Donald presents the idea of taking courage to be honest about ourselves and with ourselves. That means we may have to reevaluate how we invest our time, our energy, and our money. It will mean that we have to just find someone and be gut-level honest. Get rid of the mask, quit playing the games, and just get real with people and allow them to find out who we are and them, well, we who they are. Now, there's risk involved in any adventure like that. There's the risk of rejection. There's the risk of standing alone. There's a risk of being exposed. But unless we start risking, we're never going to know the benefit of authentic, intimate relationships. The next book I read was You Lost Me. And this one is written by Dave Kinneman. He wrote a book a number of years ago called Unchristian. In the book Unchristian, he pursued millennials. And he asked them, what do you think of the church? All right? And went through and just laid the church open. And in a good way. I mean, he really let us know what people, how people perceived in the millennial generation, how they perceived the church. And there were some hard words in there, but there was also some encouragements. This one, in You Lost Me, he turns the tables. He asks students that grew up in the church, some of us in this room, ask this generation who grew up in the church how you view the church. Now, there's no way to take into account every answer that he gave or the respondents gave, but he was able to kind of narrow down general fields, and it was really interesting. But one of the things he starts with saying is that this generation is growing up in a time that's unique from any other generation in the history of our nation or probably the world. This generation has nearly unlimited access to information. When I was in school, I had to write a report, and I had to go to the library at school or the Pottstown Library, check a book out, like one of those big ones, not like a little reading book, like a big one. And then I had to do the research, make all kinds of notes, or go to the encyclopedia at the top of my stairs. All right, that's what we had to do. Now my kids just pull up their devices or get on the laptop and boop, all this information. Now, and that doesn't mean that all the sources are good, but they have access to infinitely more information than I ever imagined could be gotten from a phone, of all things. So they have nearly unlimited access to information. And this is, I guess it could be good, but one of the results of it has led to feelings of alienation. And we all see this as older people, and some of us have fallen into this trap too, that they're always sitting next to the person and chatting with them via phone instead of via mouth. It's something that we never understood because we didn't have that access growing up. But they're growing up in an isolated culture, and it's not just this relational peer-to-peer. It's the nuclear family, the traditional family, is getting farther and farther away from their experience. Farther and farther away. So they have access like crazy. They are experiencing alienation from each other and from the family. And the last unique hurdle that this generation faces growing up is growing up in a post-Christian culture. I never thought growing up that we would get to the point where we are today. I just never imagined that it would be like this now. This year is the end point of the Back to the Future 2 movie. Like if you've seen the movies, you know they travel from 1985, 30 years in the future, to 2015. And, you know, that's the kind of view we had of the future. And now we're here, and it's not like that. We don't have rocket cars or anything like that, or our shoes don't, like, well, I guess the Reebok pumps did. But but we have other problems that we never imagined back in the day. But these kids there's an assault on assumed authority. This generation, it doesn't take us long to read the paper, to watch the news where there's another police officer shot, soldiers being shot, not at war, but at home. The traditional authorities that we just respected because it made sense, it was common knowledge, you respect these authorities, they're under assault in this generation, oftentimes by this generation. So these kids, these young adults, have more access to information. They're alienated from authentic relationships. And the authorities that we've always assumed are under fire, if not underwater. In response to these factors, the author has found that this generation, the millennial generation, is leaving church. Now, this is no surprise. We've known this. This is quantifiable. Kids go to college, and they oftentimes stop attending church. But he looks at it and says, okay, how are they doing this? What does this look like? And he was able to put all these young adults, these millennials, into three categories. And they're general categories again, okay? The first one is that of nomads who have left the church but still consider themselves Christian. Like they still refer back to the times when. Or if you ask them, yeah, I'm a Christian. That's the nomads. Then you have the prodigals. These are those who have basically deconverted. And in case you've never heard the concept of deconversion, I want you to think of it this way. We always pray for conversions. We pray that people will leave their former way of life and choose to follow Jesus. Well, just reverse that process and you have a deconversion. And I'm finding even my peers, I find on Facebook, people that I went to Bible college with. It's shocking. You kind of read some of their stories and you find that they're in the process or already well on their way of deconverting. It's interesting, but it's a thing. So that's the prodigals. And the last group are the exiles. Now, an exile is one who is living in an area that is not their home, naturally, but they still have some kind of affinity and connection to that place. The exiles, they still remain in the church, but their culture is not the same as the church. But they stay. They're trying to balance the struggle between staying true to their culture because that's who they are, but staying true to the church because that's what they believe. So those are the three general groups. Now why? Why have these students left or young adults left the church? The author presents six causes of this migration. Some may be foreign to you, and I ask that before you react and scoff at them and say, oh, not us, oh, not here, think about the young adult that might be sitting close to you. This might be their story. And we need to at least consider that we need to listen for a little bit to another generation and what they're sharing with us. The first one, the church was found to be overprotective. In our attempts to protect our children from the pain of the world, we have tended to isolate them and put them in little subculture bubbles. And what happens too many times is that does not prepare them for life outside. And they can react and go off. And when they leave that safe little bubble, we kind of look at them and we call them to repent and return to the bubble. And that caused a number of students to walk away from their faith. In another example, the church was found to be shallow, at least from the respondents' perspective. They observe adults who aren't connected to the history of their own faith and are superficial as they engage in the things of church. This mostly looks like us going through the motions and not being engaged to the joy and the energy of knowing, worshiping, and serving God. I'm guilty of this one. Okay, I will acknowledge, I will admit that there are Sundays that I come to church because it's my job. I stand up to sing because it's expected. I don't know if you do, but I know I have done it. And if I do it just once and someone sees me and they detect that hint of inauthenticity, that could be another stone on top of their position. All right, the church was found to be anti-science. Now tonight we're going to look at this at high school group, that the church isn't anti-science, and the science itself is not anti-God. But this is what the respondents gave. See, as the culture adopts more and more theory as science and not as theory, and as they shame faith rooted in the Bible, the church has dug its heels in more and more and has to have an enemy, and science has, unfortunately, too many times, because they don't know what else to go after, has become the enemy. The church was discovered to be repressive. Now, again, this is as the culture tilts away from God, and we hold on to things like absolute truth, all right, ultimate authority. We're going to, of course, seem repressive because we're not moving along with the progressive culture. All right, so, you know, we have some room to talk in that one. Also, the church was found to be exclusive. Not in the way we might like Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Okay? Not that kind of exclusive. But the kind of exclusive that says, only those who are deemed acceptable can join. And that's not what we want. The last of the accusations against the church, or the findings against the church, was that they leave no room for doubts or questions. We've all struggled at moments and at times in our lives with questions or doubts about our faith, about God. It's normal. It's a part of the maturation process. But have we allowed the younger generation to hear us, to see us wrestle with these? Have we allowed them to journey with us as we've struggled through some points of our faith? But fear not, all is not lost. The book ends with pages, like 40 pages, of ideas on how we can engage the millennial generation with the timeless message of the gospel that can help further the conversation and build a connection between generations. Now, the other books I read were more about entertainment than anything else. I'm in the middle of reading through a teen dystopic series. I just finished the third of four, that's a hint, books. Okay, don't worry about that. All right, I also picked up a couple of primers, one on psychology and one on architecture. During high school, I wanted to go into architecture. I desperately wanted to go into architecture. I was accepted at three different universities to pursue that and chose Bible college instead. And now I realize that was the saving grace of God. As interesting as that stuff was, I had to really work to finish the book. But the other one, the psychology, was amazing. All of a sudden, the things I was seeing in dynamics were made sense. And I've already talked, well, I haven't talked to Ann about the book per se, but I could see me taking up psychology as a hobby. I'm just saying. I might ask you to come into my office and do a test. I don't know. If I tell you to find the cheese, you know it's a trap. Anyway, one of the other things I was doing was reconnecting with God. During my sabbatical, I had, for lack of a better term, an advisor. Johnny Brenner, our former worship guy here, walked with me as I processed things that were going on in my head, my heart, and he addressed them. We did laugh a lot, and we dug around a bit in my heart. He would say really annoying things, like we'd be having a heated conversation or a heated debate, and he would stop and go, "It seems like you have a little bit of energy behind that response. Do you think there might be a reason for that?" And I would promptly tell him to shut up and keep moving. But I did take time when those moments came up to examine why. Why did I react? And one of the examples of this was in my first elders meeting back. Larry can attest to this, or Bob or Dean. I was asked a very simple question, and I reacted viscerally and unnecessarily, and I had to check myself. And I had to go, wait a minute, that's not the right response. What else is going on? And I confessed that I was in the wrong, and we moved forward there. But that's what would happen oftentimes as Johnny and I would be in this conversation. One of the things that I was processing through this is the guilt, is the relationship between guilt and shame. And I'm not a scientist. I don't know all this stuff. It's just anecdotal, observational, as I've worked with students for 20 years. And I myself am in the process of growing up. All right. So I see this working like this. And when I say guilt, I don't mean the guilt of legal guilt before God, and, you know, not that kind of guilt. I'm talking about the interpersonal guilt, the struggle we have with friends, with family members, even within ourselves sometimes. But that's the kind of guilt we're talking about here. And I think that we deal with shame, even if we don't think about it like that. But I believe guilt and shame have become major drivers in our interpersonal relationships, in our financial decisions, and even in our journey with God. Here's how I see this working out. When somebody does something kind or generous to us, our relationship is now out of balance. It has been skewed. It has been weighted against us, in a sense. Even though we've received the kindness, the generosity, it's now like, oh man, now I owe them something, and now I have to balance it. Just, you know, just give a gift in kind, and you move forward. That's the way it should be, right? But it doesn't work that way. Oftentimes what happens is we perceive that any gift we could give would not be sufficient. Oh, they were so kind. Or they host us for a meal, and then we go to their house. No, wait, they host us for a meal, then we go to their house. No, wait. They host us, and then we host them, okay? But our meal wasn't as good. Our kids were misbehaving, and we perceive that it's not balanced yet. Or maybe too much time passes, and then you just feel awkward. Like, oh, how do I, oh, thank you. 3 months after you gave me that gift. Thank you. Sorry. but all of a sudden now, when there's that inequity and you feel that awkwardness, that's when the shame comes in and you kind of, oh, hi, and you move along quickly. Or you start to avoid them altogether. But shame is a lot like the silent treatment. It doesn't actually work. And we have to find ways to kind of stem that shame that we feel. So some people will eat. I enjoy my fair share of eating, okay, to stem the pain or the shame. Some people will go out and buy because that, for at least a little while, makes them feel better. Some people will consume something, whatever it is, to make them feel less shame. But the reality is, it never actually works because shame sticks. So if you don't avoid people and then go to those other ways to stem the shame, maybe you lash out. This is I'll give you an example from my own life. My wife is amazing when it comes to details. She's teaching me a lot. She handles our finances. So oftentimes she'll be at the laptop. This is her at the laptop, all right? And she's doing the finances. She looks at me over there and she says, "Do you have any receipts?" And I'll say, "Yes, I do." I'll go to my bag and I'll pull out my receipts and I'll put them on the desk and I'll go back to what I was doing, probably watching TV. And she'll say, "What was this one for?" I'm like, "Oh, let me look at it. I don't know. What was this one for?" "Oh, I don't remember. What was this one for?" "Quit asking me. I don't know what it's for." The reason I reacted like that was because I realized that she was being good and kind to our family, and I was the numbskull who wasn't just doing the generous thing of acknowledging what I spent money on, being responsible. And instead of avoiding her, which I would do sometimes, "Oh, she's on the computer, let's go away." You know, I would lash out at her because I felt the inequity in our relationship. She was being responsible, she was being efficient, and she was asking me reasonable things, and I, in turn, was not reciprocating, was choosing to not balance our relationship. Now, I'm working on this. She doesn't have much room to work on. I mean, she has things to work on, but that's not one of them. So I'm working on it. I'm writing down what things were spent on, you know, so it's good. I'm almost always remembering to give her those receipts. So we're working on that. But that's one area that you might choose to respond when you feel the shame, to lash out. But there's another option. There's another option. Instead of shame, we can counter that guilt with truth and peace. In John chapter 8, verse 32, Jesus says, "If you know Jesus, you know truth, and that truth will set you free." Okay? Freedom from shame and definitely freedom from guilt. Romans chapter 8, verse 1, "Therefore now there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus." Boom! In essence, we're walking around as followers of Jesus like a mafia guy. Nothing sticks. All right? You can make an accusation, but Jesus took care of it. You can't make me feel guilty. Now, the Holy Spirit can convict. That's a different story, okay? But I don't have to walk around feeling guilty all the time because God took care of my inefficiencies and ineffectiveness in my sin on the cross. Colossians 3:15 speaks to when we have those old feelings of shame and guilt creeping in, what we can do. It says, "Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts." Now, I've come to understand this passage. This is kind of cool. It's football season. NFL gets going today, right? We'll skip that game on Thursday night. It really wasn't worth anything. Anyway, my two least favorite teams in the entire world. Unless, of course, no. That's it. Those two. Anyway, moving forward. Sorry, Zach. Where are you? Anyway. So football gets going. Football has referees all over the field. This verse tells us to allow the peace of Christ, the position we now have in Christ, to have peace with God, to rule in our hearts, to be the umpire, to be the referee. When feelings come across our mind, when things come across our heart, are we going to go, "Oh no, I feel this way"? Or are we going to stand in the true peace of Christ and go, allow that peace to say, "Nope, that's out of bounds. Nope, that's not real"? And walk in truth in God. Okay? That's the other option we have. In walking around with shame, we can own in truth and peace the message of Jesus for us in our hearts. We're never going to be clear of guilt or shame, but we can certainly claim victory, little victory over little after little victory, as we allow Christ to work in us. Now, the last thing before I finish is that while I was away, I spent some time just away. And I was trying to listen to God. I don't listen very well. Although I found out my hearing is very good. Very good. I don't listen very well. But I took some time to listen. And while I was away, I began to feel, that God was shifting what He was calling me to. I don't know what this looks like yet. I don't know when this will happen. But I feel that God is shifting and leading me in a direction that might end up being a completely different adventure. This is not a resignation. Don't worry about that. Okay? That's not what I'm saying. I don't know what this is. I'm just giving you a heads up, because someday down the line, there might become a time when I'm not here and I don't want anybody to go, what happened to John? I'm giving you a heads up. I don't know what God's doing, but he seems to be stirring in me something different, leading me in possibly a different direction. I don't know. So I ask that you pray along with me as I consider what God might have for me. And I believe that's all I have.
Thank you, John. All right, if you can join me in singing Take My Life and Let It Be, the final three verses, please stand.
You bow with me as I dismiss you with a benediction. Father, we thank you for your working in John's life, his family, and in the life of Crossway Church.